My assignment is just to outline the major views or approaches to the book of Revelation. And I have a timeline here because the thing that has the greatest impact on the view that's taken, or the thing that is sort of the most different about the various approaches, is where this view is going to place the contents of the book on a timeline. Where do we fit this in? Is it, you know, happening right away, or is it somewhere at the end, or somewhere in the middle? And so we'll try to identify those locations for the various views. And what I hope to do is not to go into any single view exhaustively. We won't really have time for that. As you're all well aware, or most of you are well aware, premillennialism is probably the most talked about of the views of the book, which is why I'm giving you the handout. That way I don't have to spend as much time on it, because I know you've got some information about that. And it gives just a general outline of the premillennial approach to the book. And then each point is numbered, and the numbers correspond to the points, and they have a description and stuff like that. So that's what's happening there. You gotta go see with mommy, buddy. See mommy. Good boy. Thank you. The other goal that we have, in addition to outlining the views of the book, is to give enough background information. And this is really a whole lectureship idea. No one on the lectureship committee was under the impression that we could do like an exhaustive exegesis of the whole book of Revelation in 2 days. But what we thought we would try to do is give enough background information and some known points that people could go home, open the book for themselves, and read it and get more out of it than they were before the lectureship. And so that'll be our secondary goal. So we'll review these views for the purpose of helping us when we approach the book in our own personal study. This is one of those books that, and I bet you can all share an experience like this, that people will sort of claim for whatever they want to claim it for. Now, I can give you an example just from this last week. In a town near to Meaford, there's some debate about whether or not the town council can say a prayer before council meeting. So someone's gotten courts involved, and it's a whole rigmarole. And so one of the ladies at church, in commenting on this, says, "Boy, this is terrible. They want to take prayer out of the council meetings." And as she tells me how terrible it is, you know, she says, "You know, it says in the book of Revelation that this kind of thing is going to happen. And boy, the end must be coming, because we're talking about that." And probably most of us have had an experience like that, right? Some contemporary event has caused someone to say, "Well, this must be such and such." Of course, many people who do that think that Matthew 24 actually appears somewhere in the book of Revelation. And you see a lot of kind of crossover along those lines. But because of that understanding to the book, it becomes important for us to have a reasonably good approach. Someone has said, "Well begun, half done." And so we'll try to get off on a good foot so that we can do better as we work our way into the book ourselves. And so one last goal for myself personally, and that is to have people who have spent some time here together with us to go home and open the book of Revelation and read it. And read it in a way that can have some meaning and some application and some relevance for our lives. Because I think there's a lot of good, important material there. In fact, the book itself claims a blessing for those who read it. So, that said, let's do some talking about the various ways in which people have approached this book. And I'm not going to be strictly chronological here. I thought about that approach, but then I was like, well, it's actually not that important. So we'll just kind of go 1 through 5 and work through these. The first one is what we'll call the preterist view. Anyone heard that term before, preterist? The term just means past, and it conveys the idea that someone who holds this view thinks the events in the book are in the past. We're reading about things that have already happened. So that actually means that this term properly applies to two of the views we're going to talk about. I'm going to apply it to those who place the contents of the book right here. And what do you suppose this endpoint represents?
Destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah, the fall of Jerusalem in AD 7. So these would find in the book all of the sort of political and historical things that happened leading up to and including the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so that'll be an end point. Among our brethren, Foye Wallace Jr. took this view. And were he alive, I wouldn't want to say too loudly that I disagreed with him, because he was known to be a man who could defend himself fairly effectively. But nonetheless, he wrote a commentary that took this view, which wasn't terribly well received. But there it is. Now, I will say, much of his other work is outstanding, Bulwarks of Faith and the like. So, some challenges. Each one of these views, I'm going to give you the gist of the view and some of the good things about it and some of the bad things about it. Of course, the good thing about it is, if you read through the book, you begin to get this idea that there's an enemy to God's people and that God's going to intervene to deal with that enemy, right? So, if you get that impression from the book, which I get from the book, then why would it be a bad idea to say, well, clearly, as I read the New Testament, the enemy of the Christians were the Jews, and so God is going to step in and intervene and stop the organized Jewish religion from opposing Christianity? I mean, it's not totally outlandish to suggest that, is it? Further, in chapter 11 and verse 1, we're going to measure the temple. Well, how are you going to measure the temple if it's not there? So this must be written before the temple is destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. There you go. So there are some things that lend themselves to saying, yeah, this is a pretty good view. There are some things that would cause us to question that. Does anything jump into people's heads as we start talking about AD 70? Talk about dates, right? What date do we normally associate with the writing of Revelation?
96.
Yeah, somewhere about 96, right? And of course Eusebius said that. Now I know Eusebius said some things that very, very likely didn't happen. But 96 is the date often attached to this book, which is one of the problems with this view. You have the book being written, you know, out here after all this stuff has happened, and the book claims to be a warning about stuff that's going to happen. Of course, people who hold that idea that the book all happens before AD 70 do take an earlier date, right? This doesn't allow for a terribly good explanation of the last few chapters. I think it's hard. One is hard pressed to explain chapter 21 and 22 within the context of everything before AD 70. That becomes a real challenge for us. As well, it becomes a very specific and centralized type book. It becomes difficult to make application for those of us who are here and around alive today. We could certainly make application to the people at the time, but it becomes difficult to make it a more broad application. We're going to get some back and forth along those lines. So that's let's call it the early preterist view, because there's going to be another preterist view that we're going to talk about. The next view that we want to think about, and these guys are far enough apart that I think I can use the same color of marker and not have any issues. The next view is the futurist view. And this is actually, I'm not trying to be to scale, okay? Let's just put it that way. Let's just say that so I can not have to worry about my lines. So the futurist view, kind of as the name implies, takes the whole content of the book and puts it into the future. And so what you have now is the book's written back here, but it's talking about all of this stuff that comes up at the end of time. This is the view that is quite popular in, you sort of have this type of a thing happening, because you get some of this end time stuff happening here, but then the significant thing happens where, if you've seen the Left Behind series, a whole bunch of people just vanish off the face of the earth, right? Are we familiar with, has anyone seen one of those movies? I've seen at least part of it. I can't seem to remember how it ends, so I'm not convinced that I've actually seen the whole movie. But I do remember watching the part of the movie where, you know, everything's going along happily, and then all of a sudden, like, planes are crashing out of the sky, and cars are crashing into things, and, you know, because all these people have vanished, they've been raptured. So the rapture comes in as part of this view, and then you have this tribulation time, where all kinds of major things happen with the Antichrist and the beast, and at the end of that, you have the Battle of Armageddon. And at the Battle of Armageddon, you know, you kind of have the battle lines are drawn, and just when things are about to get going, Jesus returns. That ends the battle, and commences the 1,000-year reign of Christ with his people on earth from Jerusalem. So that's the futurist approach to the book.
Is that futurist from chapter 4 on? After he writes the seven letters, and then all that's going to take place in the future?
That's right.
There are some that even would make the first three chapters future.
Like, yeah.
You know, how Lindsay claimed that those weren't really written to those churches, but there would be a Laodicean age and a Pergamum age when certain things would characterize the church worldwide. And by the way, we're naturally living in the Laodicean age.
There you go.
That makes us last days?
Well, lukewarm.
we're lukewarm. Well, yeah, so we've got the whole book, and in some cases, as you point out, there's some very, how would you say, dedicated people who are saying, no, the whole book, and I mean the whole book, moves to the end. Now, are there some things that lend themselves to a futurist view? Sure there are. Have you read the book? I mean, you don't see those kind of things happening now. You certainly don't see them in history. I mean, I've never seen beasts running around and people coming out of the water and all this kind of stuff. So if it hasn't happened, I mean, it must not have happened. So we must have to wait for it to happen sometime down the road, right? And so those who take this view will generally say they take a literal view of the book. And, of course, what they mean by literal is when they like it to be literal, they take it literally. And when not, then it's not. Because the beast still isn't a beast, it's a person. But that's okay. There are some things that lend themselves to this view. Are there some pretty grandiose things that go on? Well, sure. And probably we've all read the descriptions of the locusts coming, which are actually Apache helicopters, and the tanks and the nuclear weapons that are all described in the book. And so there have been some people who have found this view very appealing. And there's another very appealing thing about this book, and that is it has a broad appeal in the sense that it sells. It looks very Hollywood and very, you know, great big things are happening, and I mean, it's dramatic, and so, boy, if you want to tell someone about something fantastic, well, you just go to the book of Revelation and you kind of get them hooked there. And, of course, were someone to make a movie who took, you know, the philosophy of history view or the preterist view, it probably wouldn't be quite as exciting of a movie as the Left Behind series. So there are some things that lend themselves to this view. There are some problems as well. Many of those problems come right in chapter 1. And I'm going to see how this goes this time. Many of the problems with this view have already been mentioned at some point in the lectureship. So we're kind of getting near the end. So let's see if you guys can remind me of some of the things you've heard. And I happen to know at least two of our speakers have specifically mentioned things from chapter 1 that become a little problematic if you're going to move everything far into history. What does chapter 1, verse 1, and verse 3 say that may be a problem for this? You remember someone suggesting something?
shortly take place?
Yeah. Says, to show his servants the things which must soon take place, sending his servant to the angel John. And then it says later, those who hear and who keep what is written, because the time is near. So the first recipients of the letter are told these things are coming quickly, and now we're going to say, well, quickly doesn't mean quickly. It means, you know, who knows how long out here at our point, you know, at least 2,000 years, and however long we're around after that, if the Lord comes back tomorrow, then it's like 2,012 years or whatever. But quickly and 2,000 years, it's hard to kind of reconcile those things, isn't it? There's another problem, and that is that it removes some of the meaning, of course, for us today, but also for them as well. You know, these are suffering Christians who are being persecuted, and the book is written to provide comfort for them, and the comfort is, well, listen, like 3,000 years in the future, all this grandiose stuff is going to happen, and it's going to be really spectacular, and then the world's going to end. Well, I'm not sure how much that would help someone who was just arrested by a Roman centurion, is now going to be asked to deny his faith in Christ, and is going to have to say, well, you know, I'm going to stand firm because I know like 3,000 years from now something big is going to happen. And of course, one of the biggest problems that many people will raise in terms of this view is that it creates a strong distinction between the church and the kingdom, doesn't it? The kingdom is out here, right? It's this earthly kingdom for 1,000 years. And so the view sort of says, well, back here when Jesus came, he was going to get his kingdom going, but the Jews didn't like that idea and they wouldn't get on board. So God created this interim program. And I think those are Hal Lindsey's words, interim program, where we're going to have the church. And the church is going to go along until God can kind of re-kick off his plans. And that's going to happen, you know, way down here at the end. And that's how it's going to work. We're going to talk in a little more detail about that later. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time dealing with the kingdom stuff, because when we get to things we can know about the book, which will help us to decide which views are better or worse, we'll talk a bit about that. Then we have a really big time span. We'll call these chronologists. That is, you know, Revelation has a full chronology of church history from, you know, the time of Christ right till the end. This is the chronologist. And this has been historically a very, very popular view among Protestants. Does anyone have Barnes Notes on the New Testament on their shelf at home? I do. Probably many of us do. Albert Barnes was a chronologist. And so he sees in the book of Revelation all the big things that you can think of from history. So, you know, the development and rise of the Catholic Church, and you've got, you know, the rise of Muslims. I guess I'd be a little closer back here. And you've got the Protestant Reformation, and all of the, you know, discovery of the New World, and all of these big things that we can think of as we go back through history, they're all in here. This has been especially popular, likely because, what were Protestants around 1500 AD doing? They were separating themselves from Catholicism, right? So if you have this book that talks about how, you know, Catholicism is a beast and they're horrible and no good and God's going to destroy them, man, that's pretty appealing if you're trying to separate from that group and get away from them. And so there's a lot of people that land right in this time that will be chronologists. And they're going to see all of history. And guess what else is really nice about this view? They get to see themselves. Many of the commentaries you'll find by chronologists will see Martin Luther and John Calvin, and this person represents Martin Luther, and this is John Calvin, and this is how, you know, things went forward. Well, that's a pretty appealing view if you're a Protestant who's separating from Catholicism, isn't it? It's also a pretty popular view if you are a member of a Restoration movement who is wanting to take Christianity back to the way it ought to be. And so in our popular Gospel Advocate commentary series, John T. Hines takes a chronologist view of the book of Revelation. And if you read it, you know, he'll talk about all kinds of things that go on through history and how where they're found in the book. Now, we've talked about some of the popular things about this. By the way, should be pointed out that more currently, someone who I have a lot of respect for and have read all kinds of their work, Wayne Jackson, holds kind of a modified chronologist view. I got a lot of respect for Wayne. I've heard him speak. I've read his books. Has a wonderful Acts commentary, one of the best I've ever read. And he's a chronologist, although I will say it's slightly modified. It's not exactly as I've described. Now, there are some problems with this view. And that starts with application. Because if Revelation tells of all of human history, then our part of that in this huge scale can only be like this big, right? So as far as what applies to me in Revelation and how it relates to my life as a Christian, there's only a very small piece. I can look back and see things that have happened, and I can presumably look forward and see what has happened. However, that kind of brings us into one of the other shortcomings of the book, because what do you suppose happens if we put some X's here, and let's say all of these people are writing a commentary and they're chronologists, guess what? When they look at the book of Revelation, they start talking about everything that's happened back here, and they kind of always assume that they're somewhere near the end of the book, so that this thing ought to come to an end, you know, somewhere here shortly. And that just keeps happening as the commentators move forward. They kind of keep saying, well, you know, this stuff has all happened, and we're somewhere here, and there's only a little bit left after me. And so it becomes very subjective. People tend to look at the things that are going on around them and say, well, this seems to fit, and so I'm going to say, you know, I'll find this in chapter whatever of Revelation, and I think, you know, that describes the, what, you know, if you're writing today, you may say, well, this has got to be Barack Obama's presidency. Just seems so, you know, and whoever comes into term next time, you may find their presidency in the book as you look at it the next time. So that's one of the problems. It's incredibly subjective. It's also very Western focused. All of the commentaries that I've ever read, and I have ever even heard of, talk about Western Christianity and problems associated with Europe and things that are going on there, and essentially ignore the rest of the world. And of course, today we know there are probably more Christians in Africa than there are in North America. So it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense where if we got this book describing church history, it says nothing about these millions of Christians in Africa. And so we've got some weaknesses with this approach as well. Now, the appeal of it is, there should be one more appeal that I didn't mention. If you've got a book and you assume that it's kind of evenly spaced in terms of time, well, if the book tells about the end of the world, I mean, what's got to be right before the end of the world? Well, whatever is happening right before the end of the world. And the longer time history goes, I mean, if the end of the world keeps moving out here, well, the book must get longer and longer, right? So again, we can see how someone could think along these lines. The next view, my line stuff doesn't work very well. So last time I represented it this way, and we'll do it again. This is the generalist approach to the book of Revelation. The idealist, spiritual, symbolic, it's had all those names. Most often you'll hear about the philosophy of history view of the book. And I've got to say, out of all the views other than the one that I hold, this one probably has the most appeal because it fits the book very well. This view essentially says that what Revelation describes is the general nature of Christian history. So that you're always going to have God's people You're always going to have some powerful force, often a political force, opposing God's people, and you're always going to have God intervening to make sure that that force can't destroy them. And so it doesn't matter what force or what political body you want to name in history. You know, that's kind of what's typified by the beast. And it doesn't matter what... And when I should have asked before when I described that, is that generally true of history? Do you usually have some faithful people? Do they usually face some persecution of some kind? And do we see the hand of God in preserving his church? Well, sure. I think that's true of history.
Book of Judges.
Yeah. So, I mean, in theory, it's not that bad. In addition, as you read the book of Revelation, does it begin to look somewhat cyclical in nature? I think so. You know, you've got seven seals, and then there's like an interlude, and then you've got seven trumpets, and then there's another little interlude, and then you've got seven bowls, and, you know, it's not much of a stretch to say that this must be describing like a pattern of history where you've got these same kind of events happening over and over again, so we're simply seeing a general explanation for how history is going to play out. I think that's a fairly good view. I don't know, I've tried to think about it. I can't really come up with too many times in history where something like what we described hasn't been the case. Has there been a time in history where Christians weren't tempted to compromise with the world around them? I don't think so. Has there been a time in history where the thinking of the world was far different than the thinking of Christians to the point that there was opposition? I don't think so. And so there's a lot that lends itself to this book, to this particular view. Now, there are some shortcomings. One of those is that as I look at the book, and as many commentators have pointed out, some of the things described in the book are so similar to specific historical things that happened shortly after the people received the book, that you start to go, well, how do you explain what seems to be clearly a reference to it, a historical event, in a book that's supposed to be purely a general sort of theory? And so that's one of the problems we have with the book. We'll talk about Babylon the Great, the harlot, in chapter 17, some of the things there that point quite powerfully to a particular historical place. There's, again, a question of application here. You know, it's sort of in response to these Christians who are suffering, the response is sort of, well, you're basically just going through what everybody else has to go through. And I mean, there's some truth to that. You know, we're told in Scripture, you haven't suffered to the extent that others have. And so, you know, you don't need to look at your life and say it's worse for me than it's ever been for anyone else. That's true. It's not terribly comforting, though. And so, in terms of application, there's some questions. And the other thing that always perplexes me about this view, and keep in mind I appreciate this view an awful lot and would probably hold this view if it weren't for the one that I do hold, I sometimes wonder as I'm reading commentaries, if it's just a general book that kind of describes the general tenure of history, then where do you get 300 pages of material about that? Seems like you could probably kind of say, well, this is generally what happens, and it happens over and over again. And, you know, even if you are fairly exhaustive, you know, you may get to 20 or 50 pages. But you go into the kind of detail that has often gone into, you go, well, that's pretty specific for a commentary that says this is a very general book that kind of describes the general tenure of history over time. And let's see, have I used all my colors? Let's use green again, because I kept the green down there. There's one more view which is often called the historical background view. It's sometimes called the preterist view, and the term preterist rightly applies. This is the last view that says, somewhere up here. That the book of Revelation describes history starting shortly after the book was written, which was probably around 96, and applies to those Christians. It is speaking of God dealing with the opposing power, which is the Roman Empire. And so it starts here, you know, telling them these things are going to happen, and the book ends, you know, chapter 17 through 19 with the final fall of Rome. And, you know, this line can't be very definite because the date that Rome fell depends on who you read in terms of when that was. You know, I've kind of read everything from about 425 to 480. I don't think there's anyone that says past 500, is there? I haven't come across that, but so we're talking about sometime in the 4th century that the book kind of comes to an end. Now, there is one modification that we need to mention, which is that this view generally allows for another little line down here. Or maybe even over here would be better. So that they would say, well, the book does speak to some things about the end of the world. And so God is going to wrap things up. And now it should be pointed out, there are commentators that will say, you know, as you read chapter 21 and 22, it's describing the church. It's not describing the end of time. But generally, people will say this kind of talks about the end. Now, there are some weaknesses to this view as well. One of them is, and this one especially bothers me, because I'm kind of an analytical person, I like specificity. If you say that Revelation is describing this past history back here, I would like to know, you know, exactly what, and where, and how, and why. But that information is just not available. Even commentators who take this view and can write very exhaustively and know a great deal about the history at the time will have to say to some things in the book, I mean, I just don't know what this is. I don't know who it's talking about specifically. And if we were to go through the book in detail together, probably many of us would come to place and say, I mean, I don't know. I'll give you an example in a second here when we start talking about some things that we can know fairly certainly. But, you know, there are some things missing. And I think there's a good explanation for that. And maybe Nancy and Brian will know what I'm talking about if I make reference to a restaurant in Meaford, which burned fairly recently. And in fact, that restaurant used to be, it was the original Church of Christ in Meaford. Art, you would probably know as well. But for many of us, you have no idea, right? I'm referring to something that those who are in the know, they go, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. But those who are not in the know, those who don't have the background and the context, they have no clue. Now, you could probably figure it out if you went back and asked Ron Knight for some history and did some research on the town of Meaford, then you'd know. And I think there are some things like that happening in the book of Revelation. So John refers to things that they would know because they're there. It just happened to them. But from our perspective 2,000 years later, because we don't have the history, we can't know. By the way, it was Reed's restaurant. Reed's was a very popular restaurant, won all kinds of awards. They were in the building that had been the Church of Christ building up to, I think, like 1859 or 1849. And then the restaurant burned down. So people who are in Meaford, and especially people who are members of the church in Meaford, know that building very well. You can see a bit of it because we have a little sound area in the back. When the building burned, we pulled some of the wood out and had it milled and turned it into like our sound thing. I don't know what you even call it, but So it's there. But someone in Meaford would know for sure what I'm talking about. Someone not from Meaford, and someone especially, you know, what if you made the same statement I made 300 years from now? Well, now you're really in trouble. And the further forward you go in time, the harder it gets. And so there are things in Revelation that I'm sure John's readers went, I know exactly what he's talking about. But for us, because we don't have the full background, we may never know exactly, for example, the second beast. Staff mentioned this morning that he believes that's the cult of emperor worship. When I was taught Revelation the first time by someone who takes the same view as Staff, they said that was probably the Praetorian Guard. Well, can one of them be absolutely certain that their view is correct? No. And they both know that. But there are some things that we just can't know for sure. We'll talk about that again as we move forward. So, those are the general views of Revelation. And the way we approach the book, as I said at the start, has a great deal to do with where we place the contents of the book in history. The last thing that I want to do is to talk about some things that we can know for sure about the book. I was lost one time. I was out in my grandparents' bush hunting. And somehow in the process of hunting, I got turned around a little bit. And I came out at the wrong, you know, imagine a square, roughly square forest, and I came out on the wrong side. So when I come out of the bush, I'm expecting to look ahead and see a fence line and the house. Come out of the bush, there's no fence line, there's no house. And I'm like, well, what have I done? So I look around and I start trying to find some things that I'm familiar with so that I can reorient myself and get back to the house. I would suggest to you that there are some things in the book of Revelation that we can know, that we can use to orient ourselves, to help us to kind of keep going, even though we may not get every detail right, it will at least give us enough direction that we can make some sense out of what's happening. Some of those things we've already talked about. In chapter 1 and verse 1, there's this little phrase, "He made it known." Made it known. In the New King James Version or the Holman Christian Standard Version, which I especially like, that phrase is, he signified it. And there's a marginal note associated with that word that says, made it known through symbols. And so right from chapter 1, verse 1, John uses a word that clues us into something important. And that is, this is a book in which symbols are used to communicate a point. The symbols are different than what we're used to, but we're very used to using symbols to communicate, right? You know, if you see a kind of an outline of a guy standing like this on a sign, you know that's the men's bathroom, right? You don't need anything to tell you other than that symbol, and so we're fairly comfortable using symbols to communicate. The book of Revelation uses slightly different symbols than we're used to, so that can be a bit of a challenge. But we know going in that this is going to use symbols to communicate to us. So we can know what we're dealing with. Sometimes the book even tells us what the symbols are, doesn't it? In chapter 5 and verse 8, there are some golden bowls of incense referred to. And the book tells us what those are, right? Anyone recall that?
Prayers of the saints?
Yeah, those are the prayers of the saints. So, sometimes we're even reminded that this is symbolic, even though, you know, we're told in chapter 1. But every once in a while as we go along, we get reminded, by the way, this is a symbol. That's helpful. That gives us something we can know. And so when we start going down a road where we begin to make these things very literal, we go, wait a second, hold on. This is a book where things are revealed through symbols. So I need to keep that in mind. The second thing we can know is that this is a book written to show God's servants what must soon take place. And so if we get into, that's chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 3, and so if we get into this thing where we start pushing things way off into the distance, we can say, wait a second, let's just think for a minute about some things that are going to soon take place and what that means and how we ought to apply that. Now, I should point out, by the way, that my list doesn't include anything regarding the hermeneutics of apocalyptic language. I'm assuming that Jim covered all that. So we can kind of add to this list all the things we know about interpreting apocalyptic language. We're not going to spend time on that here, just because I kind of assume you either know that or you can get your hands on a reasonably good book on hermeneutics that will talk about how to interpret figurative language. Chapter 1 and verse 9, chapter 6, verses 9 through 11 reveal something important about the book. And that is, we have some people who are undergoing tribulation. John says he's a partner in that with them. And that this book is written to offer them some comfort, some encouragement. As Dr. Noyth pointed out this morning, chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, you know, has those who've been martyred under the throne crying, how long before you avenge our blood? How long is God going to let this happen? And so this is a book written to provide some comfort and some assurance to these Christians who are suffering persecution. There's another identity that we can know for sure that actually will help us with some other things down the road. In chapter 12, verse 9, we've talked about this already a couple times today, but there's this dragon. And unlike some of the other symbols in the book, we're told specifically who the dragon is, right? Who's the dragon? Yeah, Satan. That serpent of old, Satan and the devil. So we know, chapter 20 and verse 2 gives us that same explanation. The dragon, you read dragon, remember, by the way, staff made us do this in class as well with the arms. You know, so you read dragon, you hear Satan, right? We've got some symbolism happening. So we know that Satan is the dragon. We also know something about the kingdom. This applies directly, of course, to one of our views for sure, possibly more. But we know from chapter 1 and verse 6 and verse 9 and a few other places, chapter 5, something about the kingdom. What do we know about the kingdom that the book tells us right away?
It's here.
It's here. Yeah, John's in it, and the people he's writing to are in it. And so we can know something about the kingdom right from the book itself. Anyone in here who was in Jim's class earlier today or yesterday? Somebody? Okay. Did he say anything about the number 7?
Yes.
What is number 7?
Completion.
Completeness. Completion. So, I want you to keep that in your mind just for a second, because I want to ask you about another number, and that is the number 1260. 1260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years, time times and half a time. What are those numbers? Can you give me... What is 1260 days? How long is that in years?
3.5.
Yeah, 3.5 years. 42 months is
3.5
as well. And so if 7 is completeness, what do you suppose 3.5 might be?
Halfway there.
Yeah, incompleteness. Add to that the fact that this number is used every time it's used in terms of an attack on God's people. And so each time the book of Revelation describes an attack on God's people, it's incomplete. By the way, we ought to be thankful for that. What would happen if it was complete, 100%?
We'd be here.
Yeah. So we can know about this number. It's not referencing halfway through a 7-year tribulation period. It's always referencing an incomplete attack on the church. Now these things, we can be, I have like a star right here, indicating that up to this point, we can be like really, really sure. The last couple of things, we can be pretty sure. And of course, I'm convinced, as I've already indicated, by which view I kind of hold to the book. In chapter 17, there is this harlot. Babylon the Great. I'm kind of disappointed by this Bible, by the way. I have a couple other Bibles that when it talks about she has a sign on her, it kind of inserts the sign into the text and says, I like that. I don't have it in my ESV, but that's okay. By the way, my ESV also doesn't translate signified. It just leaves it as if it's not even there. I don't like that much either. But here we are in chapter 17, and you've got this woman. She's drunk on the blood of the saints. She's arrayed in purple and scarlet and with gold and jewels and pearls. She has a cup of abominations. And she's seated on the beast, on top of the beast, which is also on top of seven horns. And the seven horns are seven hills. Now, when I start looking at this stuff, she's also referred to as Babylon the Great. Now, is Babylon used a particular way in Scripture?
Yes. It would be the enemy of God?
Yeah. Generally, it's used to represent a major cities that are enemies of God. And so if there's a major city around at the time the book is written, what city might that be?
Rome.
Sure.
How about Jerusalem?
Well, in terms of cities, and of course, if you had an 80-70, you may suggest that it's Jerusalem, but there's a little more we need to think about yet.
We straight the point right in the context as this word. Seven hills. Rome was built in seven hills. The major temples of the gods were built on most of seven.
That's right. And there was a time when I could tell you what those hills were, but that point is past. I've forgotten. However, Rome was built on seven hills. And in fact, I have, in my notes on Revelation, I copied a picture and pasted it from the British Museum, where there's a coin that was in circulation at the time. And on the coin, there was a woman. And she was seated on seven hills. And the coin was supposed to communicate the beauty and grace of the city of Rome. She's this beautiful woman seated on these seven hills. And so that tells us that at the time, that was an idea that was already in that culture. Now, our author completely twists that, doesn't he? He says, she's not a beautiful, graceful woman, she's a harlot. And she has deceived and twisted and attracted people with her, you know, wiles. And so in chapter 17, there's just so much coincidence that you start to go, boy, it's really unlikely that this is actually a coincidence. It becomes more and more likely that we're talking about the city of Rome and its destruction. There's another thing that we can be fairly sure about, and it's the last one, and that's found in chapter 13. What do we always know about Revelation chapter 13? It's the beast, right? Revelation 13, it's the beast, the first beast and the second beast. And so you've got these beasts who have various characteristics of animals and they're called up by the dragon. The first beast does the will of the dragon. The second beast does the will of the first beast. And so here's these beasts. Now, probably most of you who have read the book, as you start reading about this beast, immediately twigged on another scripture. What scripture do you suppose I'm referring to? Another book that has this kind of apocalyptic language.
Daniel.
Yeah. In Daniel chapter 7, guess what we have?
Four beasts.
Yeah, we got some beasts again. Now, could someone... We don't have a whole lot of time to do this, so we're going to have to... This is one of those places that I would encourage you to read for yourself. But, generally, how do we understand the four beasts in Daniel? In fact, the text even tells us what these beasts kind of are. But what are the beasts in Daniel chapter 7? They're four what? Yeah, four kingdoms, four world empires. Does Daniel talk about that anywhere else?
Yes, in the statue in chapter
2. Yeah, chapter 2, you've got four empires. Can someone tell me who they are? What's the first one? You, O Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar is king of
Babylon.
So, if we go through history, we get Babylon, we get Persia, we get Greece, and then we get Rome. And so, there's our statue from Daniel 2, there's our beasts from chapter 7. And so you start reading about a beast in Revelation chapter 13. Is there a world empire that you already have seen referred to as a beast somewhere before? Well, sure. The Roman Empire. And I don't think it's any mistake that as you look at the sort of characteristics of the beasts there, you get a similar thing happening in Romans chapter 13. Revelation. Why do I keep calling it Romans, by the way? Revelation chapter 13. So those are some things that we can have at least some confidence in. The latter couple of ones are maybe a little less sure than the first few. That ought to help us, though, to sort of put some pegs in our understanding of Revelation, so that not that we're going to be able to say, you know, this is, you know, Joe who lived on, you know, whatever street on, you know, in Rome. We're not going to be able to get that specific. But at least we can have a general sense for what's happening. And so, as I look at the book of Revelation, I see the opposing power to the church being the Roman Empire, especially persecution under Domitian. And then God promises to deal with that power, and he does. Now, I want to leave with one important point before we will have a little bit of time for questions, but not much. This is only short to say. When we read the book of Revelation, does anything stand out to you about the way in which it's written?
I think between Daniel and Revelation, consistent description of that beast, though you're thousands of years apart of the scene. You know, or even several
hundreds.
It's consistent. The ten horns, the ten kings,
sure.
The ten hills, and these guys, you know, John and Daniel have very little like to do with each other from the frame of social history reference.
Yeah.
The epic description is consistent.
Okay. When you read the book of Revelation, you see things that you're not used to seeing, don't you? These are graphic, grand images of throne rooms and beasts and peoples, and the whole world is visioned, and dragons flying through the sky and knocking out the stars, and all of this imagery. And when you use imagery like that, you use it to make a point. You want people to see this. You know, if you think about maybe telling a story about going to a place. I can remember walking the dog on one particular fall day, and I mean, it was perfect. The leaves, some of them had fallen, so the whole ground was covered in bright yellow leaves, and the sun was shining down, and the leaves above us were working just like a stained glass window, so all of the light coming through was kind of yellow, and the dog was black. It was just a beautiful scene as I was walking through the woods, walking the dog. And I share all of that detail to get a mental image in your head. Well, when John uses these descriptions, he wants us to get a picture. He wants us to see what he's seeing. And if you see what he sees, the points that he makes become much more clear. We're probably, not, as I said, you're not going to know every detail, but one person who has commented on the book, it may have been Summers, talks about seeing the book as a play so that these scenes come before you and you can see the scene spread out in front of you. And when you look at the scene that John has described, you're going to get a powerful point. And so I would suggest to you that you read the book in that way, that you don't miss the picture that John is painting because of the minutiae. And if you do that, you'll at least get very much of the point of the book, although you may wind up holding the generalist view, which, as I mentioned, is probably okay. I'm a big advocate of thinking about the book visually, because you don't go to that much length to describe these images unless you want people to do that. Are there any, in the last couple of minutes, questions or comments that you would really like to make?
Short question.
Sure.
What do you take from the second to last verse where Jesus says, "I'm coming soon"? I mean, I usually deal with the soons more in the first chapter than I do with this one.
Yeah, that's right. I think I would probably do the same thing and go back to the first few chapters where he's had these warnings to the churches and he's telling them what's going to happen. But each one of those churches are, the churches that were in trouble were reminded that I will come. And we know in those cases he's not talking about his second coming. He's making reference to the fact that your lampstand will get taken away because you've kind of abandoned the faith. And so when he talks about coming soon, I would apply it to that kind of a coming rather than an ultimate coming. Yeah.
For the first view you gave, you mentioned the number of church protocols you held it. For the third view, you mentioned a member of the church who I think used to live in Beamsville, John Hines, who held it.
Okay, there you go.
And for the last view, we could think of lots of people in the church that held it.
Yeah.
Xavier Roberts, R.S. Norris, so
yep.
on. But, and I, for the second view, the futurist view, I suppose, R.H. Bowl. But I,
yes.
I can't think of anybody for the fourth view. Can you think of anybody?
Was the fourth view the generalist view?
Right.
Hendrickson, More Than Conquerors.
Yeah, but he wasn't a member of the church. Somebody in the church.
Now I'm going to get, there's two Winters brothers. And I have, one wrote a commentary on Romans and one wrote on Revelation. And so I'm not going to get them right. But it's either Ezra Winters. One of the Winters wrote a commentary that I have in my library that takes a generalist view of the book. And I'm not going to get the right name, but I'm pretty sure Winters is the last name. Does anyone else know of someone who holds the...
Which was the fourth view?
The generalist view. This is just a general picture of Christian history.
I've known individuals who have, but nobody ever wrote them.
Yeah, me either. Other than, I think Winters... actually, just a second. If I have... background, philosophy of history. Of course. No, in my notes on philosophy of history from a class I took once, it says Brother Winters. So that doesn't help. But there have been, and I think we probably know people.
We can find anything on Google.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, talking about the shortness of the, or the immediacy of the book, I like chapter 22:10 where he says, don't seal up the book.
Yeah.
Because that goes with Daniel chapter 12 where he says, seal up the book.
Very good. Yeah.
Does the reemergence of Israel in 1948 play into any of this?
No, although it does in one way, because a lot of the people who were in politics at the time held a futurist view of the Book of Revelation, and so their theology was pushing their politics, and so they wanted to see a new Israel because they figured that had to happen. Not unlike, who's the guy that was a famous televangelist who tried to sneak into Israel with a bomb in the 70s? He was going to blow up the Dome of the Rock so that they could rebuild the temple, right? Because his understanding was that has to happen. So he was just going to help it along. If I had my longer notes on Revelation, I had that name written down somewhere. But yeah.
So, okay, the War of Babylon, doesn't that kind of imply that the Muslims might be involved in final disputes?
Actually, that term is applied in the Old Testament quite a bit. And really, I know you're dealing in a very general sense with the Book of Revelation. That's probably fairly wise not to commit yourself on several points. But the key to understanding Revelation is to get your head around the language of the Old Testament. So when you look at the Whore of Babylon, or a city that's referred to a prostitute, there's only one that it's ever referred to. And Rome wasn't around yet.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, I'm inclined to say that you're thinking because Babylon is probably in Iraq. No, I think that's a way of referring to
Babylon's a symbol.
Yeah. The way we would say the battle, we use the Battle of Waterloo to describe someone's coming to an end. I think they're using the term Babylon in a similar way to that.
1 Peter chapter 5:13, Peter says, I'm writing from Babylon.
There you go.
And where was he?
In prison in Rome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
From where he writes.
Yep. Very good. All right. It sounds like everyone else is wrapping things up. So, Brian, could I have you close us with a brief word of prayer?
Father, thank you so much for this weekend that we've had and for all the lessons from your word. We praise you and thank you for the messages that we find in the Book of Revelation. We thank you for our teachers that have shared thoughts with us. Father, we ask always that you guide us and give us understanding and wisdom from the letters that were written to our brethren in the early church. Help us to see how it applied to them first, and help us then to go from there and just apply all those principles to our life. Father, we are so happy that you're our God and Father, that even though we struggle and go through all sorts of oppositions and persecutions and afflictions, we always win with you, and we may not feel that at times, but we do know in the end that will be true. And we're thankful for the messages that encourage us to remain faithful even to death. And we thank you and praise you, dear God, in Christ's name. Amen.